Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. We've got Guy Riemond on the line. Nice to see you, Guy.
Hey, Dan. Nice to see you.
Guy and I have a bit of history.
We do.
Yeah, which is why he's here. He's a bit of a ledge and a really great guy. And I'm very excited to speak to him because I'm going to embarrass you now by reeling off some of your amazing accomplishments.
No.
So yeah, he's a very grounded and humble chap. So I'm going to embarrass him because he's a founder, director, investor, and advisor. We've actually first met in 2017, which is nearly 5 years ago now, at a workshop in Toronto, in Canada. And the reason I wanted to get Guy in was A, because he's a ledge and he's got loads of great experience and he's doing some amazing stuff. But I sort of intersected with him at a point where later that year, my business, which is the premise of this podcast, went south. And his business went on to go and he went on to sell his business and then do lots of amazing entrepreneurial stuff. So I want to get into like what went on in 2017. But he's got over 20 years experience in tech, software, consulting, advisory. He set up a business called Cake in 2001, which was, how do you describe Cake, Guy?
You know, I mean, it was not particularly well thought out. I'd never run a business in my life. I've made all the mistakes that you make as a, not even a young entrepreneur. I was kind of early 30s at that point. And but you know, what we aimed to do was start our own business primarily. And the idea behind it was we wanted to build websites that were, back in those days, more functional than most websites. So we actually had a database sat behind it and, you know, that kind of thing. So we offered a little bit more than just the standard brochure website, which was prevalent in those days.
Yeah, it's a very sophisticated software business, I would suggest. He's underplaying it a bit there.
Well, no, we evolved. So, you know, the way it worked really was I have no technical experience other than being a closet geek. I always have been. I love kind of shiny electrical things. And, you know, none of my career has been planned. I actually started and I worked for 11 years selling apples and oranges with Sainsbury's. That was the first part of my career. I didn't go to university. Was distinctly average at school, probably below average at school. Came away initially with 5 O-levels, which was pretty underwhelming. And then picked another couple up along the way and got 3 A-levels, but pretty low scores, E's and C's, or E's and a C. So nothing spectacular, no career plan other than I just wanted a job. So yeah, went to work for Sainsbury's, got on this training manager scheme, which actually at that point was pretty recognized, seemed like a good idea and actually really enjoyed it. Very practical. I learned so much from that, from a man management point of view, because these stores have like 350 people working in them, most of which are part-time. So you meet all sorts of characters. And as an 18-year-old, as I was then, as a trainee manager going into those environments, you have to learn pretty quickly how to deal with people that are way older than you, way more experienced than you, but you're telling them what to do. And that was a learning curve. But, you know, I think one of my abilities is to build relationships with people pretty quickly and get on with people and, you know, ultimately work with them and get them on board with what we're trying to achieve. And that kind of has been a theme really throughout my career. I'm not technical, going back to the kind of the original point, but my business partner was, and he was a young lad. He was like 19 or something like that. I was 31. But you know, he had something. He was good at sales. He never even went to college. He dropped out of college. He went to college, but dropped out early, and went into the big wide world of work. And I took him on actually when I was working at a PC World store, would you believe? So I moved from Sainsbury's selling apples and oranges into my kind of geekdom, and began to sell computers and, you know, shiny electrical things. And you know, even though my brain wasn't wired to be a software engineer, you know, I got it. And I, you know, actually, you know, software engineers are often quite different to people that work in shops or anywhere else, really. And, you know, I was able to get on and understand that kind of thinking and that, you know, people with very much a maths kind of mindset. So we kind of built this company on the back of me floundering and trying to run a business and Rob being actually technically really capable. You know, we started doing simple stuff, but it became very apparent very quickly that he was capable of way more. He was just naturally gifted in that area. And we started to build more and more complex systems. And eventually, you know, we were not front-end guys. You know, our creativity from a look and feel point of view was awful. You know, it's a very subjective area anyway. It's a tough area. So we naturally kind of moved into the more technically difficult, but actually more lucrative area of the back-end software development. Mm-hmm. And we started building online systems back-end systems for companies on a bespoke basis. So that's kind of how we started, really. No plan, quite frankly, no idea. But we knew we wanted to do something and, we kind of made it work. But there's several things that I'm sure we're going to come on to where we were close to going bust at particularly bad times during my personal life as well.
Really? I really love this because as you can hear from a humble chap with humble beginnings with his academic career and his career in retail and what have you, set up this business and you're being very downplaying it a bit, but he went on to be supremely successful. It's exited into a business that was became part of Disney Streaming Services as it is now. Guy does now is he's got involved with a private equity fund. He's got a startup hub in Manchester. He's got a firm in Florida, which is aiming to be the largest law firm in the world that doesn't employ any lawyers. So this dude who's very sort of telling me about his Sainsbury's career and his career at PC World has got this international entrepreneurial investment portfolio of businesses right now, which is really spectacular. So there's this kind of interesting story here of the last sort of 20 odd years. But I want to sort of, and I do want to get into all of those stories about your near-death experiences in yeah, or your glorious exit to Disney. But I want to just zero in on this 2017 thing, because for me personally, that was my kind of year zero. The premise of this podcast, for those that don't know, is that I got a company called The Tech Department, which is still going, and it's going well, actually, now, thank goodness. But at the time, it was going super well and then fell off a cliff due to, let's call it, bad management. So in 2017, I thought I was king of the world. I'm in Toronto. I'm hanging out with all these amazing entrepreneurs. I think I'm hot, you know, whatever. And then at some point during that year, I remember actually distinctly having a cup of tea with you or with you and another chap, and we were chatting about things. And it really became apparent to me that, well, A, my business wasn't going very well. And I thought, hang on, I've just built a house on sand here. And I remember chatting to you. So I'm curious to find out, my story is the premise of this. I went, you know, had my sort of moment of truth in 2017. What happened to you in 2017? What was going on with Cake?
So I guess the this part of the story started in 2016. So I've kind of described where we were at the start, and you know, I don't know, a $6,000 job was big for us back in the early days. You know, that and you know, as you're aware, Strategic Coach has this thing called the largest check. And, you know, the aim is to just make that largest check bigger and bigger, and you think of strategies as to how you can do that. And we started working with early days, even from probably 2006, we were formed in 2001. We started to work with like large government organizations. We bid for projects against the likes of Fujitsu Siemens, and we won. And so our checks started to get bigger and bigger. And, you know, by 2016, really, we didn't do any jobs that were under kind of seven figures. You know, all the companies were working with the big companies. We were deploying teams of maybe 20 people into these things over a sort of 12, 18-month period and working with them and moving them from the technology they were on into this new technology that we specialized in that they wanted to move to. That's what, you know, we took a big bet in 2010 and moved from what was a standard, you know, something called Java. Yeah, most of the top 500 Fortune companies were systems are built using this kind of technology. And we moved into this relatively unknown, only just come out of academia type of language. But we felt it was, and when I say we, it wasn't my genius. It was the genius of my CTO, Jan Mahacek, who'd kind of done a load of research and development projects. And he spotted that, he felt that computing had to move to in a different direction to cope with the internet and the high bandwidth requirements. Dan, I'm sure you're in the queue for the Robbie Williams gigs at Nebworth on Ticketmaster. And listen, what happened every time that was released? What happened to that system?
It broke.
It broke every time. And, you know, so systems weren't able to deal with these sudden spikes in demand. And, you know, as soon as Robbie Williams tickets released on Ticketmaster, you go on there and boom, down it went. And you had to wait hours while it kind of picked up. So the technologies that Jan had picked up on were far more able to cope with this. So long story short, we started to specialize in this. Big bet. We bet the company on that. We moved the company to this new technology. And fortunately, the technology started to grow and we started to grow with it. And we had found a niche that we became famous for. We were great at shouting about what we did. We didn't employ any salespeople at all, ever. We had myself and the commercial director, Pete Everson. And between us, we grew the company and we had inbound calls because of our niche, because of the way that we projected ourselves out into the technical community. And so we got to a point where in 2016, our largest client at that point was a company called BAMTech. Now, BAMTech were one of these big companies you've never heard of, American organization. They were the first ever company to stream a live sporting event over the internet. And it was a baseball game. And it was in the days of the sort of 33.5 board modems and stuff like that. You know, it was very early on. And it obviously really highly pixelated, really poor quality. But the point is they did it and they started to build the business on the basis that the bandwidth available to consumers was going to increase, and it did, and their quality increased. And they then had subscription services for all the major American sporting events. That's where their business was. And they built a business that was, you know, I don't know, valued probably around about the sort of $3 billion mark. So a pretty serious business. And it emanated from an idea out of Major League Baseball. They were, you know, a company owned by Major League Baseball. And they became famous for having a really stable, high-quality platform. And in 2016, Disney came along. They were getting a little bit of stick around what their vision was for streaming, because obviously Netflix was doing well, and you know there was various streaming services coming online and absolutely killing it. And you know, what was Disney's plan? Well, Disney's plan actually was a really smart one. It was to buy into BAMTech, and they bought, I believe, around about a third of the organization for a fairly serious amount of money. Then they were going to come in and if all went well, you know, buy the company and use the platform that BAMTech had built to start Disney Plus as a starting point. So really, that's exactly what happened. Now, we knew that Disney owned a third of BAMTech because, you know, it was out there. It was a thing. And BAMTech came to us. They'd been following us for a few years. We didn't know. We had no idea. We weren't looking to sell. They asked us if we were interested in selling, and I said no. That was my instinctive answer. We just put a 3-year growth plan together. We'd had 5 years of pretty good growth, you know, in coach terms, strategic coach terms, with 10 times everything and more. You know, we felt we could really build the business significantly on the back of what we were doing and what we were becoming famous for in our little niche of technology. So anyway, they came along. I said no. They said, well, okay, joint investment. Yeah, okay, maybe. Yeah, maybe that might really help our growth over the next few years. So long story short, went to New York, met with the guys. They made a pretty significant offer. And I felt that given the organization, given what was going to happen with the organization, that A, from a shareholder point of view, it was a really generous offer, and B, from a my team point of view, don't forget, you know, we'd built this business over quite a number of years, and a lot of these people were friends. But I felt that it was as good a company as we were going to find to move my organization forward to a place that it wouldn't be able to do on its own. You know, we were working on a project that would become one of the biggest software engineering projects in the world, really. They currently, I don't know, the last figure I heard, and this is in the press, so hopefully it's correct, they've got 120 million plus subscribers already in the first couple of years of their existence. That's huge. The technical requirements around that kind of ability, plus the functionality that, you know, has to be built into these things, it's massive. And so we were, you know, we were proud, really, that a company was interested in what we were doing. And it was all around those technologies that I described back in 2010 when we made that bet. So, you know, ultimately, they made an offer, and the deal actually went through in the end in 2017. And I think, actually, the story is probably the day that we had that cup of tea, the deal went through at 5:30 in the morning Toronto time. And I'd given power of attorney for my non-exec to sign on my behalf, which was a smart move, because apparently there was a significant number of documents you had to sign. It took about 2 hours to go through everything and sign it all off. Wow. I got the text at 5:30 in the morning. I just woke up in Toronto, 5 hour time difference. I still wasn't on Toronto time at that point. And woke up early, saw the text, deal had gone through, and we had that chat. And Dan, you know, you showed no outward signs of the difficulties you were facing in your business at that point.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because it was happening and I was feeling it, and I was having a bit of a kind of realization actually at that point that this is a deeper problem than a sales blip. I think probably what was going on for me when I was speaking to you. So it's interesting that we can crystallize it around this cup of tea, where on the one hand, you've got this text saying you've just been able to you know, go through this transaction on this enormous project that's this global impact at scale. And meanwhile, Muggins here is like realizing in the same moment, he's had a text from the universe telling him that, oh, hang on, you've got this wrong, mate. So it's kind of an interesting moment, but I think this is part of our entrepreneurial life, and it's quite interesting, I think, is this sort of like success and failure, the line between it. So this is an interesting moment, and I do want to get onto what happened next after that, 2017. But you mentioned about things, you're skating close to the edge at various points to that point. And I was listening to your podcast or one of your podcasts earlier, and he's talked about celebrating success and failure. So looking back now, that kind of period, we're in the run-up to your sort of glorious exit. What were your most successful failures at Cake?
So listen, I'll start by saying, I think there but the grace of God, every entrepreneur goes through those moments, and some are fortunate and get through them, and some are not so fortunate, and you know, the business goes properly south, and that's the end of it. So I honestly think any entrepreneur that has built a business over a number of years has had those moments. And you know, the reason I think for the success of your podcast is that no one talks about that kind of stuff. But it happens to, I would suggest, a very high percentage of entrepreneurs. So, you know, just going, you know, I said in 2001, I had no experience in building a business, and quite frankly, I had no idea. And, you know, we did the easy thing. We actually opened up in an old cotton mill in Manchester, of which there are lots of them. And they're all being repurposed for various things, predominantly small businesses. And they're perfect for you know, a business, because actually, the first thing I did was I went round and I knocked on every single door in that mill, and there was 50 plus businesses in there, Introduced myself, gave him a business card and said, this is what we do. We build websites. And if you need a back-end building, we can build a back-end as well. And actually, the first 2 years of our existence was built on the back of that kind of thing. So that was quite easy, right? Because you're just knocking on doors, you're saying hello to people. I was good at that. You know, I'd have a cup of tea with them like I did with you. And it was all good. And I began to struggle really when we were coming out of that period and we were looking for the next largest check. And my marketing capability was really poor and I had no idea. And 2004, we literally just ran out of work. And we were running on jet fumes at that point. And we were 2 weeks away really from folding. That's how close it was. And we had one glimmer of hope, which was actually a long shot for us, really. It was a reasonable size organization compared to the ones we were working with. It was a company called the National Union of Student Services Limited, so the NUSL, the acronym for them. And they did some kind of cool stuff, really. What they did is student union bars are so cheap because NUSL bulk buys on behalf of these each of the student bars, and as such they get discounts, but the discounts can be really complex. So, you know, it's not just like you'll get 10% off if you buy this much. It's like you get discounts in the future or you get money back, and there's different schemes for different suppliers and all that kind of stuff. So this system was really quite hard, and you know, they needed a computer to work it out. And actually when we'd finished this in the end, they saved a seven-figure sum by the computer being able to work out more accurately than a human the discounts that were available to them. But anyway, that's the side story. 2004, we pitched for this thing, and this was life or death for us. And Rob was the more charismatic person in the group, which is unusual for the sort of the technical world, but he was brilliant. And he led the pitch. I obviously joined in and did part of it as well. And the bottom line was, fortunately, we won it. And it was a reasonably significant piece of business that would keep us going for a good few months and buy us time then to go out and find some more work. So, you know, Rob nailed the presentation. We won the piece of business. We escaped by the skin of our teeth. And we were able to then build the business a little bit further. And then, you know, again, still, we hadn't cracked the whole marketing thing. And 2007, one of the things we did that began to solve that problem was we started to produce expert content. And this is before the days of blogs and definitely before the days of podcasts. But we did it with books. And we wrote, Rob and a couple of the employees began to get involved in writing books. And we actually, in the end, I think we wrote about six books that were published. And listen, you know, if you and I, if we read them, it'd be Cure for Insomnia, because they were technical books, highly technical books. Good Doorstops, Cure for Insomnia, but for technical people, they were gold dust. And, you know, we wrote these books, and one was called The Spring Framework, and it was an area we were beginning to specialize in, and we wanted to make our name for ourselves before we switched technologies in 2010. And this book generated, it was the first time ever we had incoming sales inquiries, which was brilliant, from a government organization saying, we've read your book, we want to build our system in this technology. This was a maverick government department, because most government departments don't have a clue, or didn't in those days have a clue about that level, that detail of technology. But this, it was a consultant, called us and said, look, we'd like you to tender for this because we think you'd be perfect for it. And we did, and we were up against the big boys, and we were a team of seven people at that point. And we nailed it. We won the business. And actually, then we worked with that government department for quite a few years across quite a few different projects, each of which we had to tender for. But because we were so kind of niche and so specialist, and we just knew more than these other companies, our people were better at doing that stuff, that we kept winning the business. And so, you know, that kept us going. But the story with that one is that when we won the piece of business, we were due to start, and I can't remember what the date was, but we were due to start, let's just say January. And I then got an email from the person heading it up saying, I'm really sorry, we've been delayed by 3 months. We need to push the project back. And you're like, you front it up because you don't want to be seen as weak and small and everything else. You say, yeah, fine, no problem. Then you go back and go, oh my God, we don't have 3 months of cash flow. We've put our whole team on this project, which is always dangerous, right, for an entrepreneur or any businessman. But we had to, because that was the situation at that point. And I went to the bank and the bank wouldn't give us any money, even though I had a signed contract from the government to say that we had this project. They wouldn't support the cash flow, which is, I mean, we left that bank immediately when that happened, but it didn't solve the problem. I went out and got a personal loan and funded it, the shortfall in cash, and with the view, with the hope that we were going to pull it off.
Wow.
And we did, and we paid the loan off. Took us 2 years to pay that loan off, personal loan.
I mean, that's kind of like, it's a really crystallizing moment there. That's really interesting. So just dial it back then. Okay, so we're, these are two moments of in time we've just crystallized that could have been the end of this glorious future that ended up being. So just back in 2004, then, this first one. So you were like 2 weeks from folding, life or death. And you've got one, you said one glimmer of hope.
Yeah.
This project. So I don't know if you can remember, like, how did you feel like the morning of the presentation that you were about to go into to pitch? What was in your heart and mind then?
Well, I'm going to add to that, right? Because at the time I had a young family. We just bought a house in auction that hadn't had any work on it since the 1950s. It was literally, we were going to strip the house. We stretched ourselves with the mortgage already, and we had to almost kind of rebuild the interior of the house. So we had no carpets. There was no central heating. There was literally no kitchen. The bathroom needed doing. The everything inside a damp course needed doing. So, you know, we kind of just moved into this place and we had storage heaters to try and keep the house warm, but everything needed doing on it. So, and with a young family, it was the worst possible time personally for this kind of thing to happen. If we hadn't won this piece of business, so this adds to the pressure, I mean, massively, because it's personal. If we hadn't won that business, not only would the company have gone under, I would have gone bankrupt, and whatever effect that would have had on the business, on us personally, as well as the business, obviously, that would have gone, and the future, and everything else. So it's one of those that is a huge amount of pressure, but I did feel it, and clearly I was nervous, but I was also a little bit confident that we could do this. I'm always a positive person, and maybe sometimes I kind of close my mind to the worst case scenarios and just concentrate on the thing that I need to achieve and the thing I need to get done. So I don't think, I clearly felt the pressure, but it wasn't an overwhelming pressure. It was just really, really important thing for us to achieve, and we did. But like you say, it's there, but for the grace of God, because I know a number of people where they haven't been as fortunate, and it has gone the other way, and it has affected their lives hugely. And I know the mental effect that has on people. You know, one of my closest mates went through that. And, you know, even I, as his closest friend, didn't realize the anguish he was going through at that point until he told me a couple of years later.
Wow. So yeah, it's funny, is that the downside is quite down.
Yeah. You
know, as you've articulated. So it's not just a business goes pop. There's a whole other life that's attached to that business. Your, like you say, your personal life and a house and a family and a, you know, relationships and your own mental health and, you know, whatever. That's all wrapped up in this bloody pitch. So you again, it's sort of this, there's a high wire act you're walking on there. And again, this piece of stepping in to cash flow the business through that 3 month dip. Again, it was did that, because it seems like you've got this sort of, you're sort of closing off and you're able to go into the sort of zone, as it were, and focus on it. Is that what happened in your 2007 cash flow blip? Or how was that?
Yeah, I mean, whenever I face adversity, whatever it is, then I try and focus on what we need to achieve and make sure we achieve that, rather than worrying about what might happen. There's no point worrying about what might happen. If that happens, I'll deal with it, and I'll deal with it the best way I can. And it won't be pleasant, it won't be nice, but I'll deal with it. So that's the way I kind of live my life, really, to be honest. That, you know, my friends will tell me, yeah, my wife will definitely tell you that, you know, if there's something going to be written on my gravestone, is we'll cross that bridge if we need to.
Well, and I think that's kind of interesting. It's psychologically wise in the moment, because you can only control what you can control.
Yes. You do the best you can. And yeah, this is, again, something I always talk to my kids about. What will be, but just do the best you can. If you've tried your hardest and something doesn't work out, then it doesn't work out and you deal with it. But, you know, most of the time, actually, if you really focus on something, then and you keep a clear head, then you can get round issues. But if you don't, then it's amazing the number of people that are around that will help you if you really need it.
That's great. There's all these kind of interesting sort of life or lessons / life lessons in your story to 2017. And then you had this exit period, and there was a period where you were in the corporate world, which I believe wasn't your cup of tea. And we've kind of what I'm interested to get to now, actually, is sort of the world you're in now, because you went, had this little brief sojourn into, call it, corporate world. And now you're very much in working with entrepreneurs, in particularly in terms of investment and direction and mentoring. So that kind of 2017 exit thing. So what has been the kind of big lesson from that for you, and how are you applying that in the current world you're in?
Yeah. So I always knew that I would be, I'm much more suited to, I've always said I'll be unemployable, quite frankly. I wouldn't, I'd be difficult to have as an employee. And that kind of proved to be the case, because, you know, listen, the BAMTech and then Disney, when they came in, which was literally 2 weeks after BAMTech bought us, Disney came in and we, you know, Kate became a Disney company and eventually rebranded to Disney Streaming Services. And, you know, in Stockport, in London, as well as in New York, there's a whole bunch of engineers building out this amazing platform, and, you know, super proud of you know, that actually happened. However, you know, the transaction happens and your focus is on that. And that was an interesting experience. If I can talk to that very quickly, actually, because I think, you know, that's a useful lesson I learned as well, that I talk to people about now, is that I wasn't bothered at the beginning with whether it was going through or not, because I had the mindset where we were going to grow anyway. And I had a plan and I wanted to grow the business. And I hadn't planned for an exit at that point. We planned for an exit in maybe 3 years if all had gone to plan. And if it hadn't, I'd have carried on until it had. And this came, the offer came as a surprise. And for all the reasons I talked about before, we decided to do it. But, you know, for the first probably 4 months of the due diligence, these things go on for a while. What I didn't realize was, in the background, not only were they buying us and they were buying another company from Amsterdam called the Capitals, you know, Disney, the whole Disney transaction was going on in the background. So the stick I was giving them for this thing going slowly, I now understand why it was going slowly. There was a lot of moving parts at that particular point. My head was firmly in the space that, yeah, if it goes through, brilliant. If it doesn't, it's fine. We've got a plan. We're going to move on. And then I got towards the end, and the last 2 or 3 months of that were really messed, more than any other situation, actually, more than the situations I've described in the past, messed with my head, because I was starting to think about what it meant for family, for friends, and what it meant for the opportunities. You know, what kind of money does, it gives you freedom. It gives you freedom of choice. It's not for me to go and sit on a beach somewhere and do that kind of stuff. It's what can I do? What good things can I do, both personally and, the wider perspective in the world kind of thing? You know, how can I make my mark on the world? Then I was really bought into it, and the last 3 months was torture, and I found it really tough. And people noticed for the first time. I don't show weakness very easily, I don't think, and people were noticing I was struggling with it a little bit. So anyway, it happened, and then I moved into this this world of corporate, and it was everything I thought it was going to be. This company is as good a corporate as you're going to get. They were, from a people point of view, they're brilliant. And, you know, I was really pleased for the team because I think it was a really good move for most people within my team. But for me, I struggled with having to go through layers and having to spend weeks getting permission to do something. My boss was great, absolutely brilliant. But when I needed to go further afield into the Disney infrastructure, it was really hard to find the right person, and decisions took a long time. You know, we were famous for blogs. We'd written 600 blogs over a 5 or 6 year period. That's how we made ourselves famous. And BAMTech and then Disney Streaming wanted that within their culture. But then actually when it came to it, every blog had to go be run past a lawyer. Because brand integrity is really important, and I get that, I understand it. I just struggle with that kind of concept, and you know, getting things done took ages. You know, I wanted to rebrand my office because I was proud of what had happened, and I wanted to move all the cake stuff. It was a time to move the cake logos and stuff like that, and have the Disney Streaming logos, and I wanted to rebrand it. And after 6 weeks of trying to find the person that had the budget to do it, I thought, sack it, I'm just going to do it. So I did. And then I started to cause my boss problems because I was doing things without permission because I got fed up of waiting. And, you know, I quickly realized that I understand why these things have to happen in corporates, and it's not a criticism, but it's just not for me. It works for some people, fantastic, and they thrive in that environment. And I get that, but it wasn't for me. So, you know, I had a period of 18 months I negotiated. I actually did 21 months, but I felt at that point that it was better for them and better for me if I left. And the best thing I did then, Dan, actually, and again, wasn't really planned, but it kind of planned. I took a year out-ish. So I began to get involved in one or two things, but we went traveling. I went away 6 times during the course of the year with family, just for the first time since I was 17, 18, focused on taking some time out and trying to get my head around what would come next. That's what happened.
Interesting. So just dwell on that a moment, because I think that's an interesting point. You've had this very, successful entrepreneurial career that crystallizes in 2017. But the run up to that last little bit was, quotes, torture.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you're spat out of this torturous experience where other people are noticing you're having a bad experience, which is rare, and your head's been messed with. And then you spat into this alien culture, alien environment. And then you leave that, and then you're taking your year out. And just on this particular point, what were you feeling in that year? Well, because so I'm always curious, because this was your baby, this cake. Your company was your baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what was going through your mind? Because what was the emotional state you were in? After you've got built this thing, it looks really great, it's then torturous, then you're kind of frustrated, then you're out. What was that like?
So when I announced to the team that I was going to leave, my then boss and his boss, the two people that had led the acquisition of the company, flew over from America and supported me, and they were brilliant. And but it was an emotional speech. I struggled at points while I was, making the announcement, as it were. So that was tough, but actually letting go, I just felt it was the right time. So my mindset very quickly became a positive one, and as it generally does. So I got my head around it really quickly. And yes, it was my baby for all those years. Yes, it meant a lot. But once I got that speech about leaving out the way, I was looking forward then at that point. Okay, what can I do next? And that was the harder bit, actually. So it wasn't leaving. The leaving was okay because I got my head around that, because I felt that it gave me just huge opportunities. The hard bit was understanding what those opportunities were going to be, because I couldn't quite see it. And the year out, I'd recommend to anybody, you know, don't dive straight back in. Lots of people told me that, and I listened to them, and we did that. And I began to kind of, people began to call me and say, look, this is, you know, this is what we're planning. Do you want to get involved? And that kind of thing. And, you know, and I now work with sort of five organizations as a non-exec chairman and investor. The idea is they're all, and this is what I think I'm veering towards. You know, even now I'm not 100% certain, but this is what I'm veering towards. Taking companies that, where we were in 2010, where we had a great platform, I felt, for growth, and I could see where this could go. I was looking for companies like that, where they had a great platform for growth, they had good people behind it, people I got on with. The people are the single most important thing, then the idea, and then how to execute that. I started to work with people that I really liked, and you know, I'm now working with them to take them through the high growth, and hopefully for them and the people within the organization, because we try and look after everybody in every organization that I work with, take them along for the ride, and hopefully it's a successful outcome for everybody involved with those organizations. So that was the first thing I started to do. And then the second thing was that you talked about everything happens in Toronto, right? You know, we had that discussion. I was also introduced in 2019 by a friend of mine, Ash, who you might know, Ash Fora. He introduced me to a guy called Dave Zampano, just a typical New Yorker, you know, very, very kind of brash, confident, I had a really good chat with him. Sat down over lunch in Toronto, in the Strategic Coach offices, and he just muttered the words, "I need a tech guy," and I'm like, "Okay, well, I'm a geek, so maybe I can help," You know, it turns out that he had a really good idea on how to bring the legal world into the 21st century, because it, you know, it's quite slow in adopting technology on the whole. You know, he wanted, as opposed to trying to bypass law firms, he was a lawyer himself who ran a successful wills and trusts law firm, because it's a legal thing over there as it isn't over here. You know, he wanted to work with law firms to help them digitize and help them move into this new era, almost kicking and screaming. So he had a great idea. I felt that it was a sector that really needed this kind of technology. So that was the last time I met him in person, October 2019, proper pandemic story, really. And, you know, we built this platform over Zoom. So we had a UK-based engineering team. We had a Czech Republic-based engineering team. And then we had his team over in the States. And we all combined worked together really tightly and came and built, I think, I'm really proud of this platform. It's a great platform. It does solve a problem. And, you know, if we position this right, the legal world moving into the digital era is an inevitability. It is going to happen. It's happened in every other sector. They might not like it, and a lot of them don't, but it's going to happen. And it's going to happen in the next few years, happening far quicker than I think it is. So, you know, the trick is now for us to position ourselves where, as opposed to trying to bypass lawyers and build platforms that kind of negate the need for them, we're trying to work with them and give them the opportunity to use our platform to engage with some of their clients that really don't want to go into an office to sign forms or give data or whatever it is, just the simple law stuff, you know? That's a problem the platform solves.
What's the name of the platform?
It's called Guider, G-U-I-D-R, guider.legal.
Got it. Right. We're heading towards the end of our time. We've got another 5 minutes. I just want to ask you two questions. So we'll sort of, the first one is your private equity firm.
Yeah.
It's called EHE. Now, could you explain what that is and why you've called it that?
So again, another Toronto conversation, unbelievably. I've known my business partner, Gary Fletcher, for years, but it was in Toronto we had this conversation. And he said, you know, I've been thinking about private equity. He sat as chairman on with a private equity organization. He said, look, I think we could do something here. We could put put entrepreneurs back in charge if we get this right. So, you know, his feeling, and I 100% agreed with this because I've heard so many different horror stories that, you know, entrepreneurs are often caught out by private equity. You do this day in, day out. An entrepreneur raising money for the first time can make lots of errors and actually not get as good a deal as they should be getting. So what we wanted to do was build a private equity organization that recognized that and actually worked with the entrepreneurs and educated them and helped them. And we put money into any organizations that we think that we want to take out to our investor friends. Then we put our own money in and we go out to our investor friends. But everything's transparent. We have already negotiated the deal, and it's always with the entrepreneur in mind. So there's no hidden fees, which can really catch people out. You know, Gary himself's been through some of this pain in the early days when he sold his first business. And we just be really transparent, no kind of tricks of the trade, as it were. Have our flag. We're an entrepreneur first and we're investors second. That's the way we look at it. Now, we've taken that to another level now. We're actually building out a platform. I can't talk about it in too much detail yet, but we had a demo yesterday, funnily enough, and really, really pleased with what is happening. This will be announced in February at some point next year. But we're building a platform that matches entrepreneurs who are ready for high growth and need funding with investors. And the idea is that we want to be able to match them and put them in front of a number of investors to create a degree of competition with the investors, so that the power is back with the entrepreneur to a certain, the balance is better. I don't want to put the power with either. I just want to make the balance better so that the entrepreneurs have a choice. And they can choose the best one. The platform will also be educational, both from an investor point of view and from an entrepreneur point of view. We've already done 40-odd podcasts like yourself, and it's all aimed at helping entrepreneurs understand some of the things that they're going to come across and make informed decisions based on that.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, it is a world where finance and funding and investment, which most entrepreneurs don't have it at experience. So someone who can help them navigate that thorny path, I think it's very, very well done. Right, we're nearly at the end of our time. I was going to ask you, in 60 seconds, based on all your sort of two decades of entrepreneurial cutting edge experience, what advice should other entrepreneurs ignore?
I think you should ignore advice from people who have vested interests and try and talk to people who are neutral but knowledgeable on that subject area. And you know, the example I'm going to give is that, you know, you shouldn't ask for investment advice from a funder, whoever that funder is. You should ask investment advice from entrepreneurs who've been through that process and understand. They've got badges and scars themselves, so you can learn from their experience. So, yeah, and you can apply that not just to that particular scenario, you can apply that throughout your entrepreneurial career. Ask advice from people who've got the badges and scars from having been through it, not from the people that are providing that particular service. That's what I would say.
Well, that's great advice there. I think that's and very wise, because lots of people with an opinion and lots of people with advice, but often with a string attached somewhere down the line.
Yeah, exactly.
Great stuff. Well, Guy, always great to see you and share a cup of tea or virtual.
Virtual brew.
Virtual brew is the name of the podcast.
That's a very northern thing, I think, isn't it? A virtual brew.
Aye. Well, where do people find more about you, Guy?
Well, listen, you can email me directly. So it's Guy Remond. So it's GUYREMOND @gmail.com. Or you can go to the EHE website, which is ehe.capital, or the GUIDR website, which is GUIDR.legal. And lots of information, lots of ways to reach out and contact me. LinkedIn is my name, Guy Remond. I've got a Twitter account, Guy Remond. That's about it, I think, really.
Well, I think lots of ways we can contact you, and we shall be getting in touch. Well, you should check him out. Check out his, what he's up to. It's an incredible portfolio of interesting stuff going on. And I think, as you've seen in through Guy's story, there's what he does ends up in interesting places. So keep an eye on it. And I think there's loads of good stuff there, particularly if you're an entrepreneur. So thank you so much, Guy, for sharing your story with us.
I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, thank you for inviting me and for being such a, you're very good at doing this host stuff for sure. And you've been there, you've done it, you've got the badges and scars yourself. So you're also very knowledgeable in this area. So thank you.
Well, my pleasure. I always like spitting it with awesome entrepreneurs like you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to, if you like this podcast and you like our mission to help other entrepreneurs, do subscribe and share and tell everybody about it. Give us a 5-star review. Go on. That'll help us help other people. So great to see you. Great to see you, Guy. Hopefully I'll catch up with you IRL in the near future. See you next time, everybody.
Fantastic.
Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode email to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluepthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluepthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box. Just enter it in and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google, Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening. And I'll see you next time.